Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up in a little while, a visit from John Doe, the singer and songwriter who founded the L.A. punk band X, and then the Americana band The Knitters, and who is now looking back at 20 years of being a solo artist. Oh, and he's got two new films that he's starring in. John Doe will play live for us in just a bit. Here in New York this week, though, people have been thinking about dancing. Mainly because one of New York's storied venues, the Roseland Ballroom, is closing after 95 years of live music and generation after generation of dances, from the Charleston to disco to the mosh pit. We're going to take a look back at the history of the ballroom in a moment. But fans of a certain kind of dance music have been thinking this week of Frankie Knuckles, known as the Godfather of House. Chicago's house music scene of the 1980s has had a huge influence on the sound of electronic dance music over the past 30 years, and Frankie Knuckles, who died on Monday at 59, helped to birth that sound. For many years, he DJed at Chicago's The Warehouse, a bar that catered to a largely black and Hispanic gay community, and it's possible the name house music actually was a reference to The Warehouse. But that Chicago-based post-disco sound would go global, driven in part by songs like this one, a hit on the international club scene in 1989 called Your Love, from the late Frankie Knuckles. Your Love, a classic piece of house music from Chicago by the late Frankie Knuckles. Knuckles, who was actually a transplanted New Yorker, died this week at 59. And you can hear echoes of house music all over today's dance music landscape, right on up to the music of Lady Gaga. That's the sound of Lady Gaga playing this week at New York's Roseland Ballroom. The famed Midtown nightclub and dance hall is set to close its doors on Monday following Gaga's seven-night run, and it means the end of nearly a century of concerts and dance nights at Roseland. So, with another legendary New York club closing its doors, it's time for another installment of our Soundcheck series, Vanished Venues. We'll hear about the history of the Roseland Ballroom in a moment, but first, we're joined by Ira Robbins, the music journalist and founder of the magazine Trouser Press back in the day. He reviewed lots of shows at Roseland over the years. Hey, Ira.
Hey, John. It's good that I actually kept my notes for those shows.
I guess so. Well, what was your first reaction when you heard it was closing?
Kind of routine. You know, New York's always changing. I mean, they're still trying to fix it, you know, and it's been...
My entire lifetime. So where would you sit? I mean, in the musical ecology of New York City, where would you situate Roseland Ballroom?
Roseland served a very valuable purpose because it's large. It holds 3,500 people, which makes it bigger than pretty much everything except Radio City.
Or Madison Square
Garden. Which are, you know, far, far larger. I mean, Radio City is like 6,000. So, you know, for a mid-sized band on the way up that can fill a room of 3,000, it was perfect. And a lot of rock bands and metal bands and punk bands found it a very conducive venue.
And so what are some of the shows that you saw over the years that stick in the memory?
Well, Nirvana and Fugazi. I saw Green Day's first show there that when they were opening for Bad Religion, and my notes were like, these guys are pretty good. They could go somewhere, which was exciting, you know. But I also saw weird things that in retrospect seem very surprising now, like Billy Bragg headlining as a solo artist, you know, just him and his guitar. You know, that seems kind of shocking for 3,000 capacity.
Yeah, although when you're called the Roseland Ballroom, maybe the shock is to have bands like Fugazi and Nirvana, you know, amps to 11, you know, in a space like that.
I also saw the Sex Pistols there do their Filthy Lucre reunion tour, which I have a vivid memory of a stockbroker standing next to me singing along with No Future. And I was trying to imagine exactly what sort of no future he was envisioning for himself.
So was it, on balance, a good place to see a show?
It was comfortable because it was so large that you could roam. When it was crowded, it was difficult. And the sound wasn't ideal. But when they finally moved the stage to the back, and I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves
here. Yeah, we'll come back to that. But you mentioned seeing Nirvana. You saw them in the summer of 93.
Yeah, they did a last-minute announcement show that was tied into the New Music Seminar. They were just about to release the In Utero album, and they hadn't played pretty much in the States in about 2 years. You know, kind of Nevermind had been this huge explosion in 91. It's kind of stretched out for that whole year and probably into 92. And then they pretty much backed away, and so their playing the show was a big deal. My review of it in Newsday was kind of negative, that they were not really together, and my recollection of it was that Kurt looked more uncomfortable on stage than any human being I've ever seen. He basically was like stock still and miserable looking.
Huh. Well, let's hear how he sounded, him and the rest of the band. This is Nirvana, live at the Roseland Ballroom, July 23rd, 1993. Song School from Nirvana, live at the Roseland Ballroom, July 23rd, 1993. Ira Robbins was there. And Ira, you remember him as being really uncomfortable on stage? Rollingstone.com, in their bio of Kurt Cobain, says he overdosed in his New York City hotel room before that concert.
I suppose that could have happened.
And would explain
a lot of things.
Yeah. So Ira's here with me in the Soundcheck studio, this edition of Vanished Venues, celebrating a venue that is in the process of vanishing even as we speak, the Roseland Ballroom, closing with Seven Nights by Lady Gaga. And also joining me is Laurie Holcomb Holland, who is a contributor to the New York Times, and she compiled a really neat timeline of the Roseland Ballroom for the Times. You can see a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. Laurie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how far back, how long a history are we talking about with this place?
We're talking about quite a history. And, you know, one of the things that I really love about this is that it all started with a guy just wanting to dance more with his girlfriend. at the time, Lewis Brucker was a student at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And he and his girlfriend, Dorothy, who would later become his wife, they loved ballroom dancing, but ragtime was really big then. There weren't many places to do ballroom dancing, so he went and built one. In Philadelphia, right. That's opened in 1917 with a $20,000 investment from the Yuengling family. And
Yuengling beer?
That's right.
Oh,
exactly.
Okay.
And you know, things went great. He actually paid back the initial investment within the first 6 months, and things were going well. But you know what? He wanted to dance with his wife, even longer. And Philadelphia had these blue laws that wouldn't allow them to do it. So he came to New York, checked out the scene here, really liked what he saw. New Year's Eve of 1919, they open at 51st and Broadway.
As a dance hall.
That's right. Well, a ballroom.
A ballroom.
Mr. Brucker did not want it to be called a dance hall at the time. He thought, you know, ballroom was
more refined.
Exactly.
And it was, for a brief period, whites only, right?
For a while, actually. It wasn't until 1924 that black bands were hired, and even longer until black customers were allowed in. But it was, that's what it was sort of known as, the home of refined dancing for whites.
Although in 1924, when they do start allowing black musicians in, they're getting the best of the bunch.
That's right. Fletcher Henderson and his orchestra were there for quite a while, and the fall of 1924, that's when Louis Armstrong had his New York debut.
Louis Armstrong making his New York debut with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra back in 1924. Fletcher Henderson's orchestra with a young Louis Armstrong on trumpet with Sugarfoot Stomp, a recording that goes back to the 20s when Louis Armstrong made his New York debut with Fletcher Henderson's band in 1924 in the Roseland Ballroom, one of our vanished venues here in New York. Ira Robbins with me, the music journalist, and Laurie Holcomb Holland, New York Times contributor whose Roseland timeline she compiled for the paper, in which you can link to on our website, soundcheck.org. Now, Laurie, that's a recording, obviously, but in 1923, 24, 25, if you're dancing, you were probably dancing to live music, right?
That's right. And at Roseland, they would actually have two bands in a night, so you could kind of have your... You could have your choice.
So you could have a white band at one end and a black band at the other.
That's exactly right. Mm. Yeah, it was a little bit of a point of contention for some of the white band leaders.
What? Oh, because were they being like, was there a battle of the bands going
on? There was a battle of the big one that everyone talks about was when the Gene Goldkett Orchestra came from Detroit, and that was supposed to be the cream of the crop of the white players, and Fletcher Henderson's band had the cream of the crop of the black players. And it was actually, from what I've been told, different historians I talked to, the Gene Goldkett Orchestra won basically because Fletcher Henderson's band, they didn't really expect them to bring much to the table, and they didn't know about some of the musicians that were in, who would go on to become very famous musicians who were in the Gene Goldkett Orchestra.
So they underestimated their competition, basically.
That's right. That's right. I don't think it happened very often that Fletcher Henderson was bested.
So it sounds like, and Ira, this sort of goes back to what you were saying about how big the place was, that it would accommodate two bands, although I can't imagine you could have had them both going simultaneously. It's not that big a space.
Yeah, but they probably weren't amplified.
No.
So, I mean, I would think an acoustic group at one end probably could project 100 feet and the other one could project 100 feet.
And you think they could...
Yeah. Probably blurry in the middle, but, you know, the Coventry and Queens used to do that.
That'd be a fun thing to be in the middle there and hear both bands simultaneously. It sounds, Laurie, like a place that was just built on a love of dance.
That's right.
And yet, virtually every dance trend from the 40s on, at one point or another, was banned there.
That's right, exactly. It was built on a love of ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So there was a time when I actually read that the Lindy Hop was banned for just a little while because one of the taxi dancers had broken her arm.
To explain what a taxi dancer is.
A taxi dancer, or Mr. Brecker would have called them a hostess because that's more refined. Basically, it's a sort of a rented dance partner. You could pay by the dance, or you could pay by the hour. let's see, I believe it was in the 40s, they were going for three dances for 35 cents.
Mm.
And when they opened, they had 150
taxi dancers.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hence the phrase, my dance card is full.
Is that really where that comes from?
Mm-hmm.
How
there
about
you
that?
Well,
they filled
was,
out carts with the names of the people they were going to dance with.
Wow.
You know, it's one of the things I was researching last night more about the taxi dancers. They had some rules that they needed to follow. They actually kept them in a little corral where they were mm-hmm. safe from the ne'er-do-wells. and some of the rules, first of all, there was no exchanging phone numbers or arranging dates. Undergarments had to be worn at all times. That's right. And then
I love that they even needed that as a rule.
I know. Who broke that rule that it had to be established? And then no gum chewing and no slang talk. He wanted his ladies to be ladies, and that, yeah.
So. Okay. So at what point do they ban the twist?
That so the first that I read about it was in 61, that he basically said that—
This is Brecker, the guy.
Brecker, yes, said
so
that—
So in 61, he's still running the place that he founded in 1917 in Philly.
That's right, that's okay. right. And, you know, along
so
the way—
So he's a cranky old man, and—
Yeah, that's sort of, I mean, yeah, it's when you kind of look at the history of Roseland, for a long time, just as we tend to do as we get older and get set in our ways, it seems like Roseland sort of was too, and this was, you know, this was Mr. Brecker's baby, and he banned the twist, and I love there was a quote from saying that, you know, his children told him he was crazy for doing it, but the other places that allowed it, they were closed, and Roseland was still open, so, you know, must have been a good decision. But so twist was banned, and then soon enough, when his daughter Nancy eventually takes over, those things that have been banned eventually mm-hmm. come back.
And by that point, Ira, the original Roseland on 51st Street has moved. It moves, like, overnight, right, or the same
day.
Oh,
in the same day. Mm-hmm. Dorothy and Lewis danced the last dance there, and then went that at 1 a.m. it closed, and at 7 o'clock it opened at the new location a block down, and they danced the first dance there.
Yeah. So, Ira, tell us a little bit about, you know, the location. It seems like an odd place for a lot of the kind of music that would eventually come there.
Certainly in the context of New York, where most rock clubs have been built in kind of far-off reaches of the city because real estate is cheaper, you know, the idea that you could pretty much get off the subway, you know, and walk a half a block in the middle of Midtown, you know, on 52nd Street and Broadway and be at a venue was always kind of surprising. You know, I mean, everything else was like on Avenue C or,
right,
you know,
right.
you know, in Queens or, you know, on the Lower East Side or, you know, the West Side very far over. So
And you would walk past Studio 54 when—
If you were coming that way,
if you were
yeah.
coming from
right.
one of the subways.
Generally, I walk past Entertainment Weekly magazine.
Here's a couple of listener memories. Radek on Facebook leaves us this memory of Portishead. He says, despite sitting on my couch in the Czech Republic, I truly enjoyed the band's ethereal, touching sound. Beth Gibbons, smoking a chain of cigarettes, found the show to be mind-opening and so mind-blowing that I wish it never stopped. Portishead must have felt similarly because they actually released a recording of that Roseland show.
Bow and arrow, I'm gonna give my heart away, leave it to the other girls to play. For I've been a temptress too long, just give me a reason.
Bit of vintage trip-hop from the English band Portishead. The song's called Glory Box from their album Roseland NYC Live, recorded 1997 here in New York at the Roseland Ballroom, which is closing on Monday night. This is a part of our occasional series, Vanished Venues, and we're not even waiting for the venue to vanish. Ira Robbins, the veteran music writer and co-founder of the legendary Trouser Press back in the day, with me here in the Soundcheck studio, and New York Times contributor Laurie Holcomb Holland. Her timeline of Roseland's bumpy history is linked on our website, soundcheck.org. When did they move the stage, Ira?
I crowdsourced this on Facebook last night, and the closest I can come is 91. I definitely saw Adam Ant and Big Country there in the 80s when the stage was in the center of this huge rectangular box on a long wall in the back. And basically the sight lines were terrible because mm-hmm. unless you were standing directly in front of it, you were looking at a pretty severe angle.
Well, also acoustically.
Yeah,
you know,
bouncing off the back wall.
Yeah.
And when they finally moved it down to the far end, basically made the venue like a long tube, a long box with the stage at the end, and they took the old stage and made that the VIP area. So
yeah.
The press used to stand up there and be gawked at by the audience.
Which is something that our listener Ian here in New York City remarked about in his voicemail. Take a listen to this.
One of the greatest shows was the Red Hot Chili Peppers headlining, and two as yet unknown acts, Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins. But I have to say, Chili Peppers were in their element. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Watching them over an eye-level sea of moshers was an incredible way to experience that band. Thanks.
So that's back in 1991 that Ian saw the Chili Peppers and the Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam at Roseland Ballroom. So the press corps would be on the old stage.
Yeah, which they elevated like 6 feet above the audience, which
right.
felt very conspicuous.
And Laurie, I mean, all of this is happening after a second change. I mean, you talked about Brecker passing it down to his daughter. She eventually sells it, right?
That's right, in 1981. Sold it, and that's when you started seeing a lot of events that led to some major changes there.
Like what?
One patron was actually killed on the dance floor, and then a few years later, in 1990, there was a tourist from Utah who was killed in the subway by a few kids who
were... Very famous
yes.
Murder in the subway.
Exactly, and Brian Watkins, I believe
right.
his name
yes.
was, and there was some kids who were, they wanted money to go to Roseland. And it was shortly after that Roseland decided they were no longer going to do their disco nights.
Right. And four of the guys were arrested in Roseland,
that's
as
right.
I recall.
That's right.
Well, and at that point, you know, you start to see more concerts as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, these disco nights,
that's right.
nights of people just coming to dance. We're talking about the Roseland Ballroom, which is closing for good on Monday when Lady Gaga concludes her 7-night run there. Soundcheck listeners, do you have memories of Roseland? You can leave them on our website, soundcheck.org, tweet us at soundcheck, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Ira, once we start getting bands in there, as you mentioned, it's a big spot. You start getting big bands, and you even start getting the mega bands scaling down
there.
A little.
Bob Dylan played there, Metallica, Megadeth. Yeah, I mean,
the Rolling Stones.
Right. I mean, it was a fairly flexible place to play. It's a big stage. When they moved it, the room was very deep, so it had that feel of like a big audience. It wasn't this sort of sense of like people crowded around the stage. I mean, you could be a good couple hundred feet away, and it had a balcony that had pretty
mm-hmm.
good sight lines.
Well, but let me read you a comment from Jason in Brooklyn, who writes, "Ugh, let's be honest, the Roseland was a terrible place to see a concert. It was a dance hall and built like one. The venue was long and narrow, which meant even in a non-sold-out show, you were always super far away from the stage. The stage was low, there were no risers, made it hard to see the band, the sound was terrible, and the location was awful."
But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like to play? I mean, but every rock venue in New York has its limitations. I mean, you know, if there's a crowd, you can't see. If there's a stage, it's either too high or too low, you know, and sound systems are very, very hard to control in large environments. So, you know, I mean, that argument can probably be made about pretty much any place in New York. I've never walked out of a venue in New York and thought, oh, my God, this is the greatest place on earth to see music.
Yeah, although, you know, it was a big box, and it did have a kind of boxy sound.
Yeah, so does Hammerstein. And,
so does Hammerstein.
Know, so does Terminal 5.
Yeah. You know. Yes, Terminal 5 definitely does. But, you know, then you have places like the Beacon, where the sound can be quite nice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. So what does Roseland's demise say about the New York scene, the music scene?
Constantly changing. You know, I mean, you know, when CB's died, it was that was a huge big deal, especially in my world, because I come from sort of the indie rock underground punk world. You know, and the world didn't come to an end, even though people kind of predicted it would. And, you know, Roseland, okay, let's check one off that list and there'll be another one. You know, it's only a place to see music. It's not a lifestyle, you know?
So it is not likely to be the last vanished venue that we cover on Soundcheck. Ira Robbins has been with me, the veteran music writer, and Laurie Holcomb-Holland, contributor to the New York Times. Check out her Roseland timeline. It's full of really interesting bits of history from the Roseland Ballroom. Link to it through our website at soundcheck.org. Laurie, Ira, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, John.
As I mentioned earlier, Lady Gaga is performing the final shows at Roseland, and if you don't have tickets, you can watch a live stream of the very last concert on Monday, April 7th. You can find a link and leave your memory of Roseland at soundcheck.org. Speaking of live shows next week, join Soundcheck for two nights of music and conversation that we're calling Gigstock, inspired by our daily Gig Alert. We're teaming up with the indie concert site Oh My Rockness for the first night, with performances by Pains of Being Pure at Heart and Parquet Courts, Wednesday, April 9th at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to soundcheck.org. Up next, an in-studio performance by musician and actor John Doe. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. His name may be John Doe, but he's hardly anonymous. The singer, songwriter, guitarist, and actor founded the L.A. punk band X back in the late 70s, unveiled that band's Americana alter ego, The Knitters, in the 80s, and began recording solo albums in the 90s. Now John Doe is preparing to release a best-of collection drawn from his solo efforts. You can bet that this duet with Kathleen Edwards, Golden State, will be on it. And you can bet that John Doe fans like me will be whining and complaining about what didn't make the cut. My whining begins right after John plays a song for us here in the studio. It's a new one called Sweet Reward. Here's John Doe live on Soundcheck.
He was freshly shorn, and the moon was weak, and an empty street stretched out before him. He was 39 on December 10th, with a birthday 2 weeks away. The train went clickety-clickety beneath his feet, and his clothes didn't fit so good anymore. He could see his breath as he rode between the coach and the dining car. Home seemed so far away, but he got there in less than half a day. He knew the world had kept spinning all the time he was gone, but he couldn't say how it had changed. Thank you. She talked to him quietly and looked him in the eye and said, "You can stay as long as you like." He smiled a little smile when she opened the window and let a little breeze inside. He split two cords of wood and he painted the fence, and he ate good food every day. She got him a job fixing cars for her uncle. He liked getting dirty, then getting clean. When he laid down at night and held to her hand, he thought, "This is my sweet reward. This is my sweet relief. This is what I waited for. This is what I've been praying for."
John Doe, live on Soundcheck with a new song called Sweet Reward. That's beautiful, John. Welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
So
good to be back.
Yeah, with a best-of album coming out, but obviously some new songs lined up in the queue behind it.
Yeah. I've been actually working with Hal Gelb, you know, from Giant Sand.
From Giant Sand, yeah. So yeah. Down in, like, the...
Tucson,
yeah.
And then he's got a great sound through this studio called Wave Lab. Nico Case did a bunch of stuff down there, and Sam Beam from Iron and Wine, and you know, and Hal it's just got the same kind of distance, a lot of reverb, and it's like the desert.
Sounds like the desert. And, it is in the desert.
Yeah, and he's got all these crazy pedals and awesome, you know, like young players. There's a guy Gabriel Sullivan who's been touring with him, and crazy bass player Tura from Denmark, and yeah, it's cool.
So that's coming down the pike, but there is the matter of the best of John Doe this far, which comes out on May 6th. You are just inviting fans to complain about what didn't make the cut.
It was a little hard. It was hellish. I you know, called a bunch of people and said, "What should I put on there?" And then I would get like tumbleweeds and crickets. And I was like, "Help me out here. Come on. You said I should do a best of." And like, yeah, give me a... Luckily, my sweetheart, Chrissy, said, "You know, well, you got to put on Twin Brother. You got to put on this, and you got to do that one."
Golden State was an obvious
State.
One.
Yeah. So, but it was a little bit of wringing of hands. And,
yeah.
and even after it, luckily I had the record company said, "Well, we'll do a double LP." So at least I had the form of four sides of a record.
So you were thinking vinyl.
Yeah.
Okay. Why now?
Because I realized on the last record I had more solo records than X records, and I thought and like my Eddie Vedder, we you know X did some touring with Pearl Jam, and
right.
Man, you got to do a best of, you know, you got to just do best, and producer Dave Way, who I've worked with over and over again, he said, "You know, we got to do one of the." And then you realize you've got about like 100 songs almost to pick from.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard,
and that's without going into the Knitters or X,
right? Or the Sadies or Jill Sobule. Well, actually, I did pick one of the Jill Sobule, you know, collaborations we did. But
right. Well, there's a whole album that you two did together.
Yeah, she's the best. I love Jill Sobule.
John Doe's with me here in the Soundcheck studio. So, and in addition to that, now having said no Knitters, no X, you in fact do a new version of one of X's older songs.
Yeah.
And a new version of Take 52 from your first solo record. Is it unusual for you to revisit older songs like that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's not unusual, but it's sparing. Mm. You know, if I feel like I did a version of Painting the Town Blue on the last solo, you know, studio
on
record.
Keepers.
Yeah, because when it was written, I kind of envisioned it as this strange Woody Guthrie, Johnny Cash sort of song, but it didn't come out like that in the X version. And so I'd been doing an acoustic version of Painting the Town Blue, and the same thing with Take 52, because people would request it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, oh, I don't remember that old thing, you know, because it's actually a really hard song to play. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the lyric in the song, you know, this song is so hard to play, and I'm on Take 52.
Right.
And it's like, it's a really effing hard song to sing. And so, yeah, but I love the song. Exene wrote most of the lyrics. It was one of those ones sometimes she'll just write from top to bottom. She'll write mm-hmm. an entire song, like, bam.
That's here. Exene, with whom you founded the band X, for yes. folks who are coming in late to the story.
Right, right.
So the album is called The Best of John Doe This Far. I was all set to bitch and moan about how Meanest Man in the World did not make it onto the record, but you're going to play that for us, so I'm going to give you a pass. But the title This Far suggests that, you know, this is just up to a point, and right. there is more to come. I assume that was the intention.
Yes, you are correct.
Okay.
And I can't say greatest hits, because I don't actually have any bona fide hits to speak of, either with X, the Knitters, or myself. And that's good. I can be still a little under the radar, and that's okay. Yeah.
Under the radar, but back on screen. You're in this movie called Pleased to Meet Me.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem like you'd done so much acting in the past couple of years.
No, I kind of don't have an agent, and I stopped doing auditions because it's just like the process they have to do, like because of union rules and things. But you know that they have somebody in mind. You know, it's a cardboard character, and it's got like 8 lines, and you're thinking, don't you know, like, somebody? Isn't your, like, drunken cousin able to do this? You know, get Bobby Moynihan's drunken uncle to do this, because he could certainly. But, it's called Pleased to Meet Me. Amy Mann and Joe Henry and Loudon Wainwright are all in it. And it's a really sweet, like, good, solid indie movie, you know. And we made it for $2.50. Mm-hmm. And
what's it about?
It's actually based on a This American Life segment called Everyone Speaks Elton John, where this woman, Starley Klein, and John Langford from Chicago and the Mekons and all of mm-hmm. his other crazy, you know, painting and everything, they got 7 musicians together one day and recorded a song. And the song they recorded was Rocket Man.
Okay.
So in the segment, everything's beautiful and everything's fun and it comes out great and it's just a lark. But in this, then they bought that, the rights to that, and made a script out of it. Joe Henry's brother, David Henry, who he wrote that Richard Pryor book with.
Mm-hmm.
He did a polish on the script, and there's a lot more drama. Amy is sort of the Starley Klein character. I'm the John Langford character. And they have a history of working together, and then there's all... Joe Henry is the engineer. And
Do you know John Langford? Have you met him?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's all over the place.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird to be playing a friend and colleague who is still very much with us?
Well, but then his name in the movie isn't John Langford.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's Pete Jones, and he's much more of a kind of a rock icon, you know, indie rock icon, but whatever.
Right.
It was a little difficult to say, okay, well, I'm not me, but I am me, and I'm playing this part who's John Langford, but you just kind of fake your way through it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
all fronting. It is. I mean, you have to
make
those decisions.
John Doe.
Yeah, it is. It's like, who's got the best look and the best front?
Yeah.
But it had a premiere in Louisville, and they had like 800 people or 600 people come, and then it got like a little week out in the suburbs. And so, like, bit by bit, it's going to be on video on demand in May. Mm-hmm. And
so it's coming out around the same time as the Best Of collection.
I think so. And I also heard I did another one right after that called Electric Slide, which is about a bank robber in L.A. I get mm-hmm. to play a detective.
Wow.
And I think that's going to be at the Tribeca Film Festival, which is kind of...
Not this year.
Yeah, I think
this
so.
This year.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So watch for John Doe at a theater near you.
Maybe I'll get an agent. Oh, my God. I'm so excited.
Electric Slide here in New York at Tribeca Film Festival. And Pleased to Meet Me, coming out video on demand in May. May 6th is the release of The Best of John Doe. And we mentioned Poor Girl, this song by your old band X, mm-hmm. and you've done up a solo version mm-hmm. to on the record. It's acoustic. It's very folky and country-ish, sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, it'll be folky and country-ish, except with an electric guitar.
All right. It's okay. John Doe playing live on Soundcheck.
You sat at home, the windows tinted black. It hit you hard and you cried so long. Life turned and wandered, never to come back again. Take what she gives you. Don't cry when you kiss her. When you ran out of the starlight in, you were too hurt to walk, too bad to begin. I looked at the sun, but I couldn't feel sad for you. Take what she gives you. Don't feel sorry for her. Poor little girl ran away for good. I tried to explain why she won't say a thing. Sad, sad thing. I'm so far away now. How can I say why she won't talk at all? She holds a deck of cards. She wants to be alone. She says I've been very ill and I've tried waking up. Now I want to be alone. Fell out of Pete's hotel. Well, you didn't look so good and you didn't feel so well. You said, hold me tight, but I couldn't get it right. Take what she gives you. Don't cry when you kiss her. Poor little girl ran away for good. I've tried to explain why she won't say a thing. Sad, sad thing. I'm so far away now. How can I say why she won't talk at all? She holds a deck of cards. She wants to be alone. She still drinks in the dark. The radio is left on late. She saw a madman fight and break it all cause he hated himself. She felt better off cause she was only drunk.
John Doe, live on Soundcheck with a solo, plugged-in version of Poor Girl. There's an acoustic performance of that song, which is an old song from his first band, X, on the forthcoming CD called The Best of John Doe, This Far. That CD comes out on May 6th, but we're getting a preview here in the studio today. More music and conversation with John Doe in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, here in the studio with John Doe, co-founder of the great L.A. punk band X all those years ago, the country group The Knitters, and a solo artist for 25 years. That solo career is the subject of a new retrospective called The Best of John Doe, This Far. He's here in the studio playing some songs live for us, and by special request, meaning a request from me, here's John Doe playing his song, The Meanest Man in the World. Live on Soundcheck.
The wide, wide open sky. above the sage and the thorns. The rocks and pines were humming an old familiar tune. His hard black boots came crunching up this gravel road. He saw the house a mile away. The moon was just setting. The nights were darker then. Lights in the living room. He could recall that the TV was on, but not if anyone was watching. He never thought of himself as cruel. He never thought of himself at all. Kindness was always outside his grasp. He was the meanest man in the world. He was the meanest man in the world. The door wasn't really locked. Fireplace was burning. The room exploded like a bomb, but all in slow motion. Icicles hung from the roof. He remembered someone screaming. Though it was sticky on the rug, he just kept on walking. He never closed a door. He never turned off a light. He left things pretty much the way they were after he did what he did that night. He never thought of himself as cruel. He never thought of himself at all. Kindness was always outside his grasp. He was the meanest man in the world. He was the meanest man in the world. He was the meanest man in the
John Doe, live on Soundcheck with his song, The Meanest Man in the World. I've always loved your story songs, especially. I mean,
thank you.
Even when the story is a pretty dark one.
Pretty dark.
This is the case there.
There's a moment I'm not so proud of. Not that I was the murderer of any, you know, past life or something, but thank you. I mean, I think it's a very flattering, and
Some years ago when that album, A Year in the Wilderness, first came out and you were making one of your prior appearances here in the studio, I told you I had worked out most of the chords to that song, but there was one I couldn't figure out, and you showed me the chord, and I said, well, what is that? And you said, I'm not really sure. Do you know what it is now? Have you figured out yet what that odd chord in the chorus is?
This one?
That's the one.
I think it's a D7.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, be pretty much a D7. There's a D7. And right. It's just got an open.
So it's just a kind of an inversion.
Yeah, you got the F sharp and the bass, and
yeah,
it's okay. It's not stating this seven here.
So a D7 without a seven.
Yeah, it's like a D6. I don't know. Some jazz stuff. Ask your jazz pals, John. Jazz pals, you got a lot of jazz.
I'm
going
to throw it out to the listeners. Listeners, what do you think that was? If you know the chord that John Doe played, he and I would both like to know. So the album is The Best of John Doe this far. It comes out on May 6th, and it concerns itself, John, with your solo career. Mm-hmm. And when we say solo, we have to put solo in quotes because you've collaborated all through your career, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And even here, you know, Amy Mann and Nico Case and
Kathleen Edwards,
the great
Jill Sobule,
the great Greg Lease on slide guitar,
right.
And
Smokey Hormel plays on a bunch of different stuff because I've played with him
right
over the years.
So, songwriting is very much, it seems, a personal thing. But is the act of making music for you at its best? Is that a collaborative art?
You know, not to name drop, but I will. I got to be part of a Graham Parsons benefit, and it benefited MAP, which was incredibly, you know, that's the Musician's Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. Gets, you know, people who are really strung out off of dope and things like that. So it was very ironic, you know, it's like a Graham Parsons benefit,
yeah,
for MAP, but not at all. And his daughter Polly Parsons put it together, and Nora Jones played on it, and Keith Richards and Lucinda Williams, and so way down on the list, I got in there. And so that was the first time I met Kathleen Edwards and Raul Mallow and some other, Dwight Yoakam was also on it. And Keith Richards showed up early and stayed late. And it was like, exactly. You're doing this for some guy who died years ago.
Right.
He was a pal. You love Nora Jones and you want to, you know, kind of hang out with her. And you understand that this is community. And it was the SH bleep,
yeah,
you know, because like he was scheduled to be at a sound check in Santa Barbara. They gave us this bowl to work at, you know, to rehearse at before we played. And he was supposed to be there at 5. He got there at 4.
Because he wanted to.
Because he was hanging out. Because with a community, like you're saying, collaborating with people and like working in a studio is the most fun. Because you get to hang out with fun people, and you're doing something that's like emotional, and you hope rewarding for other people besides yourself, and yeah. So, and I like singing with other people, and I sang with Rhett Miller on a song, and like working with Hal Gelb now is really mm-hmm. terrific, and you know.
Yeah. So, are people missing that when they create songs by emailing files back and forth?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it can be done, and usually it's like a convenience, you know. It's just because everybody's busy or something like that. But I'd much rather hang out and I try. I think it's important to get things about like 80% done, and then, you know,
invite people in.
Yeah, don't have all your melody completely done, and don't, you know, be open to changing a few words. And I don't know how people write in the studio. That way too much pressure for this guy.
This guy is John Doe, who's been with us here in the Soundcheck studio. We are amassing answers to a question for Soundcheck's Sleepy Time Music Project, and I would like to get your answer to our question, which is, do you listen to music when you're falling asleep, and if so, what?
I don't listen to music when I'm falling asleep. Often I fall asleep while I'm listening to music. Is that different?
That is different.
Like riding in a van from point A to point B, listening to music, and then suddenly there's a...
No, you don't want to do that, John.
No, not driving.
Okay.
As a passenger.
All right. Okay.
As
All
a passenger right. with the earbuds. I find that it's the easiest to fall asleep to something that is incredibly loud and weird. Like the cramps will just put me out.
Really?
Yes, because it just kind of hits some strange vibration, some strange drone.
So the cramps.
Yeah.
Psychobilly for insomniacs since 1977.
Yeah.
You're welcome, cramps.
Yeah. I think it's been 5 years since Lux Interior passed away.
Yeah, something like
I
that.
I still miss him. He was the best. He was like Superman. the meek and mild Clark Kent by day, and then on stage it's like,
and you know, the Cramps, like your band X, with this kind of hidden layer of roots music and Americana. Not so hidden.
Not so hidden with them.
So all right, so the Cramps do it for you.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
John, always a pleasure to have you with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Looking forward to the best of and then the new album coming down the pike after that. Thanks for playing for us today.
Thanks, John. It's always a pleasure. You make us all look good. You do. When you say this far.
Easy to say on the radio.
The best of John Doe this far. It sounds like this is the real deal. I've made it. Woo-hoo.
Speaking of making him look good, we have been shooting video here in the studio today. So check our website, soundcheck.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll let you know when that's up. Gabriel is set to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a solo artist next week. Monday on the show, New York Times pop music critic John Pareles joins us for a look at Peter Gabriel's groundbreaking early solo records and his quixotic championing of world music. Plus, Dan Wilson. He wrote the bar anthem Closing Time for his band Semisonic, but he's written mega hits for Adele and the Dixie Chicks as well. And on Monday, Dan Wilson will join us to play songs from his new solo debut called Love Without Fear. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.